Imagine for a second that you're, I don't know, cleaning out your attic.
Oh, I love a good attic find.
Right. And tucked inside some dusty floorboard, you find an 1869 British penny.
Wow, okay, that's a serious find.
Yeah, but it looks a little dull, right? Like maybe a little greasy from just sitting there for a century and a half.
Makes sense.
So your immediate, completely logical first instinct is probably to take it down to the kitchen sink, grab a soft towel, and gently wash it with some warm, soapy water, just to see what you've got.
I mean, that is what everyone wants to do.
Do not do this.
Please don't.
Putting that penny under the tap will instantly wash away about 900 pounds of its value.
It is the ultimate tragedy of the amateur collector, honestly.
He really is.
Because we are hardwired to believe that shiny and clean equals valuable, you know?
Right, totally.
But in the world of everyday physical treasures, like the coins we trade and the gems we wear, the surface value is almost always a complete illusion.
And tearing away that illusion is our exact mission for today's deep
I
dive.
am so ready for this.
We are going to give you the ultimate insider's eye. We want to completely rewire how you look at the physical currency in your pocket and, the jewelry you interact with every single day.
It's going to change how you see everything.
To pull this off, we have a massive stack of source material powering our exploration today.
A really good stack, too.
Yeah, we're synthesizing a comprehensive 50-year coin collecting guide by Chards,
Which is fantastic.
plus a wildly intricate breakdown of the minting process from Bullion Max,
That one blew my mind.
and a fascinating look at coin anatomy from Numismax. Oh, and a literal masterclass on using a jeweler's loop from the Plum Club.
What I love about this particular stack of research is how it forces us to constantly shift our perspective.
How do you mean?
Well, we're going to bounce between the heavy, like industrial violence required to mass produce an object, and then the delicate microscopic observation required to actually understand its worth.
I love that contrast. And by the time we wrap up, you're going to understand the physics of why a totally flawless, breathtaking sapphire should actually send you running in the opposite direction.
Absolutely.
Plus, how a tiny glass lens tricks your brain, and why the coins rattling around in your car's cup holder secretly have three sides.
That third side concept from the Numismax source is the perfect gateway into this whole hidden landscape.
Yeah, let's start there. Because most of us pick up a coin and see a binary object
That
when.
exactly. There's the obverse with the portrait
Yeah.
and the reverse with the eagle, or, a monument.
That entails.
Right. But the most important piece of real estate on a rare coin is actually the edge.
The part we completely ignore.
Completely. But according to the source, if you are handling a high-value coin, you should literally only be touching the edge.
So, what is it about that thin rim of metal that makes it so crucial?
To understand the edge, you really have to look at the history of financial crime.
Financial crime. Okay, I'm listening.
Yeah, the edge isn't an artistic choice. It is a vital security feature. If we go all the way back to ancient Rome, counterfeiters were making illicit molds.
Oh, like casting fake coins out of cheap base metals.
Exactly. But the casting process would inevitably leave a telltale seam along the outer rim.
So the edge was the immediate physical evidence of a fake.
Exactly that mechanism. And as we move into early American history, the crime shifted from casting fakes to stealing from the real thing.
How do you steal from a coin?
It was a practice called clipping. Bad actors would take genuine silver or gold coins and physically shave tiny slivers of precious metal off the outer rim.
Oh, wow. And then they'd just spend the shaved coin at its full face value.
You got it. And over time, they'd melt down the stolen shavings into a whole new ingot.
That makes the edge of a coin function a lot like the tamper evidence seal on a bottle of medicine.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it, yeah.
Like, you don't necessarily look at the seal for the artwork, but if it's broken or missing, you instantly know the contents have been compromised.
Precisely. So to fight back against clipping, early silver dollars and $20 gold pieces started utilizing lettered edges.
So they'd actually put words on the rim.
Yeah, the mint would literally press phrases, often in God we trust, deep into the rim.
Oh, that's clever.
Right. If you were a merchant and you couldn't read the lettering, you knew the coin had been shaved.
That is so simple, but so effective. And today, edges come in a few different forms, right?
Yeah, you have plain edges on pennies and nickels, which actually makes them highly susceptible to dings and nicks.
And then you have the reeded edge, like those vertical grooves you feel on the side of a quarter.
Exactly. And the source mentions that those reeded edges are a massive tell for modern collectors who are, you know, sorting through bulk coins.
Yeah, they give the game away immediately.
Because before 1964, most U.S. silver coins featured reeded edges and were struck in 90% silver.
Right, so if you look at a stack of those older coins from the side, the edges are purely silver in color.
But if you look at the edge of a modern quarter or dime,
you see a prominent copper-colored stripe sandwiched between two silver-colored layers.
Exactly. It's visual proof of the modern clad composition where copper is sandwiched between a copper-nickel alloy.
It's crazy how much information is just sitting there on the rim.
The edge is so critical to authentication that major independent grading services recently had to entirely redesign their plastic certification slabs.
Wait, really? Just for the edge?
Yeah, they re-engineered the packaging just so buyers could peer in and verify the edges of sealed coins.
Which brings up a staggering mechanical question for me.
Okay, lay it on me.
If the edge is this vital security seal, and the obverse and reverse are packed with intricate portraits, dates, and, like, microscopic mint marks,
yeah.
How is all of this physically stamped into a blank, hard disk of metal in a single moment?
This is where we turn to the Bullion Max breakdown of the minting process.
Oh, man. The numbers in this report are wild.
They really are. It is a masterclass in the application of extreme violent physics.
Violent is the right word.
Yeah. The core of the operation relies on a machine called a hubbing press, which delivers 265 tons of physical force.
265 tons.
It's massive. But the true genius of the minting process isn't just the pressure. It's the generational reproduction cycle.
Okay, break that down for me.
They use a system that essentially functions as a nesting doll of positive and negative steel molds.
Let me see if I can summarize the mechanics here, because it sounds like a massive game of mechanical telephone.
It kind of is.
Okay, so it starts with an artist's digital design, which a CNC machine mills into a piece of steel called a master hub.
Right.
This hub is a positive image, meaning it looks exactly like the final coin, but they don't use that to strike coins.
Nope, that would ruin it.
Right. So they put the positive masker hub in the 265-ton press and slam it into a fresh steel cylinder, creating a master die, which is a negative inverted image.
Correct.
Then they take that negative master die, slam it into another piece of steel to create a positive working hub.
Don't track it.
And finally, that positive working hub stamps the negative working dies. And those final working dies are what actually strike the blank metal discs to make the coins we spend.
You nailed it. That's the whole cycle.
But why introduce so many intermediate steps? Doesn't the crispness of the artist's original design degrade every time you stamp steel into steel?
Well, yeah, you lose a microscopic fraction of detail.
So why do it?
The trade-off is absolutely necessary because of the sheer metallurgical stress of mass production.
Oh, because of all that friction and heat.
Exactly. Think about striking metal all day. A steel die striking relatively soft copper pennies will only survive for about 1 million strikes before it fractures or the details blur out completely.
1 million strikes sounds like a lot, but for pennies, that's probably nothing.
It's literally a few days of work. And a die striking harder metals, like dimes, might only last 275,000 strikes.
Wow. So they are just constantly burning through these heavy steel dies on the factory floor.
The turnover is relentless.
Right.
If the mint didn't use this multi-generational hubbing process, they would have to completely re-sculpt the original master hub every few days.
Oh, that would be a nightmare.
Right. So by isolating the original artwork behind multiple generations, the mint can endlessly stamp out fresh working dies without ever risking damage to the source code, so to speak.
That makes total sense.
And to even survive a few hundred thousand strikes, these working dies undergo intense heat treatment.
Like forging a sword.
Pretty much. They bake the steel at 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, plunge it into water to quench and harden it, and then temper it in a 450 degree oven.
Just to give it enough flexibility so it doesn't shatter under those 265 tons of pressure.
Exactly.
And that extreme industrial process is just for the regular pocket change.
Oh, yeah. The regular stuff.
The source gets into the manufacturing of proof coins, you know, the elite presentation quality coins made strictly for collectors.
Right, shiny ones.
Yeah, and the science reads like something out of an aerospace laboratory.
The treatment for a proof die is an entirely different echelon of manufacturing.
Because they want that specific look, right?
Yeah, the goal is to create a background field that looks like a flawless liquid mirror with frosted foreground details that pop out in stark contrast.
It's such a striking visual.
To achieve this, technicians actually daub the proof dies with a specialized diamond-based paste and hand-polish them under microscopes.
Hand-polish. And to create that frosted look on the portraits, they don't just etch it. The source says they use precision lasers.
Yeah, lasers.
By vaporizing microscopic pits into the steel, the laser creates a textured surface that scatters ambient light, which our eyes perceive as a soft white frost against the mirror background.
That's brilliant. And the final step is arguably the most fascinating part of the whole process.
What happens next?
The polished dyes are placed inside a vacuum chamber.
Okay.
Once the air is entirely sucked out, a process called physical vapor deposition occurs.
Vapor deposition.
Yeah, basically vaporized chrome is released into the vacuum, and it settles onto the dye to form a microscopic, ultra-hard protective layer.
And they need the vacuum so the chrome doesn't oxidize or get messed up by air molecules?
Exactly. If there were any oxygen or ambient air present, the chrome wouldn't bond perfectly evenly. This vacuum-sealed chrome layer ensures the dye will impart an absolutely pristine, flawless finish onto the final collector's coin.
Which brings us right back to the attic and that tragic 1869 penny.
Yeah, yes. The soapy penny.
Right. We have this flawless object forged in a vacuum chamber, achieving what the Chard's 50-year guide calls a fleur de coin.
A perfect specimen.
Right, but then it enters the real world. It goes into pockets, cash registers, and jars. How does the numismatic world actually quantify that inevitable damage?
Well, collectors are fanatical about the state of preservation. The industry relies on third-party independent grading services.
Primarily PCGS, the Professional Coin Grading Service, and NGC, the Numismatic Guarantee Company.
Yeah, they act as impartial judges of condition using a strict 70-point scale.
70 points.
Yeah. A coin graded PO1 is poor, which is basically a flat disc of metal where you can barely make out a date.
And the top.
The absolute pinnacle is MS70, or Mint State 70. Meaning the coin shows zero post-production imperfections, even under 5x magnification.
Which implies that every single microscopic interaction a coin has with its environment knocks it down that scale, just destroying its premium value.
Every single touch.
Which is why grading services are so dogmatic about the golden rule of collecting. Never, under any circumstances, clean your coins.
Never. We could return to your hypothetical attic penny to explain the physics of why cleaning is so destructive.
Let's do it.
The Chard's guide notes that an 1869 British penny in original mint condition, possessing its factory mint luster, you know, that original satiny bloom.
Yeah.
That can easily fetch £1,000.
But the finder thinks the dust makes it look cheap.
Right. So they take it to the sink. And the problem isn't just the soap. It's the environment on the surface of the coin itself.
A dust.
Exactly. That century of dust contains microscopic particles of silica and grit. When you apply a towel and soapy water, you're essentially turning that surface grit into a wet grinding wheel.
Oh, that makes me cringe just thinking about it.
Yeah, the pressure of your fingers rubbing the dirt creates thousands of microscopic hairlines and scratches across the delicate metal.
And you strip away the mint luster forever.
In 3 seconds, the value of that penny plummets from £1,000 to a mere £100.
It's a 90% loss in equity because someone thought they were doing a good deed.
It happens every day.
And the guide points out that beyond just avoiding scratches, collectors actively desire the chemical reactions that happen to metals over time, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Like when silver interacts with trace amounts of sulfur in the air or in paper envelopes, it oxidizes.
And that creates a natural tarnish called toning.
Yes. And rather than an ugly black crust, a silver coin can develop incredibly vibrant bands of indigo, emerald green, and deep violet that look like an oil slick.
It's beautiful. And connoisseurs pay massive premiums for original toning.
Huge premiums. If you dip that coin in a harsh chemical solvent to make it shiny white again, you strip away decades of natural character.
Same goes for copper, right? Using brass polish on an old copper penny strips its deep chocolate brown patina and leaves it looking like a cheap, chemically burned arcade token.
It looks awful. The physical history of the object is the value. Erasing the history erases the worth.
But this introduces a massive logistical problem for me.
What's that?
If dipping a coin in chemicals destroys it and a towel creates hairlines so small you can't even see them with the naked eye, how are the graders at PCGS or NGC actually evaluating these MS70 claims?
We have to shift from the macro world of 265-ton presses to the micro world.
Right, because whether you are grading a silver dollar or evaluating a diamond, the definitive tool of the trade is the 10x jeweler's loop.
The Plum Club provided a masterclass source on this specific piece of equipment. A 10x loop magnifies an object 10 times its actual size.
But a professional doesn't just use a standard magnifying glass, do they?
No, they use a triplet loop.
Meaning there are three distinct lenses stacked together inside that tiny metal housing.
Exactly.
Why go through the trouble of engineering three lenses when one magnifying glass seems to work fine?
Well, a single curved glass lens introduces massive optical errors. The triplet design corrects them.
Okay.
One lens provides the magnification. The second lens is aplanatic, meaning it corrects spherical distortion.
Oh, because if you use a cheap magnifying glass, the image warps and stretches at the outer edges, right?
Exactly. The aplanatic lens ensures the image stays flat and focused from edge to edge.
And the third lens?
The third lens is achromatic, which corrects color fringing.
Color fringing.
Yeah, a single lens bends different wavelengths of light at different angles, creating artificial rainbow halos around the object. The achromatic lens realigns the light so you see the true natural color of the gem or coin without optical interference.
Wow, so it's a very precise instrument. And the mechanics of using the loop are completely counterintuitive, too.
Very much so.
The source provides this brilliant audio tutorial on the ergonomics. Like, you don't hold the loop out at arm's length.
No, you'd never get it steady.
Right. You slide your index finger through the metal cover so it acts as a handle. Then you anchor the hand, holding the loop firmly against your cheekbone to create a stable tripod with your body.
It's all about stability.
And you don't move your head to focus. You slowly bring the gem or the coin toward your eye until the surface pops into crystal clarity.
That's the trick.
But the wildest part of the tutorial, you must keep both eyes open while doing this.
Which takes a lot of practice, because your brain desperately wants to squint your non-dominant eye shut.
But squinting flexes the facial muscles, and over hours of grating, that leads to severe eye strain and fatigue.
Exactly. By keeping both eyes open, you train your brain to passively ignore the unfocused image from your free eye, allowing you to observe for hours comfortably.
What blows my mind is how the loop reveals physical density as a visual cue.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah. The source talks about evaluating facet edges on gemstones. Because diamonds are a perfect 10 on the Mohs hardness scale, they are incredibly dense.
Right.
A master gem cutter can polish two facets of a diamond until they meet at an infinitely sharp razor-thin angle. But softer stones, like quartz or tourmaline, simply cannot hold a microscopic edge without crumbling.
They just chip away.
Right. Therefore, the cutter has to leave the facet junction slightly rounded. Under a 10x loop, you can literally observe the physical hardness of a rock just by looking at the geometry of its corners.
Yeah. You are literally reading the structural integrity of the material through light.
Once you master that cheek anchor and the focus, the real investigation begins. We've established that on coins, we are looking for damage, you know, scratches, cleaning marks, dings.
Yeah, surface issues.
But when we transition to gemstones, we are looking for something entirely different. We aren't just looking at the surface polish. We are peering deep inside the crystal lattice to read a geological diary.
Because the interior of a colored gemstone is a frozen record of the exact chaotic conditions under which it grew millions of years ago.
We are specifically hunting for inclusions.
Right. And an inclusion is any internal characteristic, like a trapped mineral, a fracture, a gas pocket that disrupts the flow of light through the host stone.
The examples detailed in the text sound like alien landscapes.
The diversity is staggering. For example, if you look deep inside a natural sapphire, you might see what looks like fine intersecting threads of silk.
Silk inside a rock.
Well, that silk is actually microscopic needles of a titanium dioxide mineral called rutile. When these rutile needles align in perfect 60-degree geometric patterns, they reflect light to create the famous six-rayed star effect, or asterism, seen in star sapphires.
That's incredible.
And if you look inside a spinel crystal, you will frequently find tiny, perfectly formed octahedral spinel crystals trapped entirely inside the larger host crystal.
It's a literal geological nesting doll.
Exactly. The text also highlights peridot, which is famous for lily pad inclusions.
Lily pads?
Yeah. A tiny mineral crystal gets trapped during formation, and as the host peridot cools and shrinks, the trapped crystal creates a tiny curved stress fracture around itself that looks remarkably like a lily pad floating in a green pond.
That is so poetic.
They even detail a specific trillion-cut amethyst from Morocco. Suspended inside this purple gem is a negative cavity containing a trapped bubble of gas and a drop of ancient water, sealed off from the outside world since the Jurassic period.
See, this completely flips the script on how consumers are taught to buy jewelry.
It really does.
Marketing campaigns condition us to seek out flawless perfection. We want the highest clarity grade with zero internal marks.
Ashway.
But based on the geology you're describing, these inclusions aren't flaws at all. They are nature's unforgeable certificates of authenticity.
You can't fake a Jurassic water bubble.
Right. Which begs the question, if a buyer is offered a massive, completely flawless, utterly perfect ruby or sapphire, should that actually trigger a massive red flag?
In the colored gemstone market, absolute perfection is the loudest alarm bell you can hear.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Finding a massive crystal that grew in the violent, shifting, mineral-rich suit of the Earth's crust without trapping a single impurity is statistically improbable.
So what are you actually looking at if it's flawless?
More often than not, a completely flawless colored stone is a synthetic fake grown in a sterile laboratory, or simply a well-cut piece of glass.
And the 10X loop is the ultimate lie detector here.
Because it exposes human tampering.
Let's break down the mechanics of those lies. What does a laboratory fake actually look like under the loop?
Okay, so the most common synthetic sapphires and rubies are created using a process called flame fusion.
Flame fusion. Sounds intense.
It is. Technicians take powdered aluminum oxide and drop it through a superheated torch. The powder melts and drips onto a spinning pedestal, slowly crystallizing into a cylindrical cone called a boule.
So it's basically building the crystal drop by drop while it spins.
Right. And because the boule spins as it grows, the color layers build up in concentric circles.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, so when you put a suspected sapphire into the loop, you look at the color banding. Natural tectonic growth produces straight, angular stripes of color.
But if it was spun in a lab...
If the color banding is curved, you instantly know it was made in a lab. The curve is the smoking gun of a flame fusion synthetic.
That is fascinating. What about stones that are pulled from the earth but heavily manipulated before they reach a jewelry store?
Emeralds are a prime example of this. Natural emeralds grow in highly volatile conditions and almost always feature an internal network of fractures and fissures.
They're naturally cracked.
Pretty much. And unscrupulous vendors will sometimes soak a highly fractured emerald in specialized oils or epoxy resins that have the exact same refractive index as the gemstone.
So the oil fills the cracks, allowing light to pass right through them.
Exactly. It temporarily makes the fractures invisible to the naked eye.
But under a 10X loop, the trick falls apart.
Completely falls apart. The light catching the oil inside the crack will flash with a distinct multicolored radiance.
Like an oil slick on a rain-soaked street.
That is exactly what it looks like.
And the source mentions heat-treated rubies as well.
Yeah, heat treatment is incredibly common. To improve the red color of a low-grade ruby, producers will bake the rough stones in commercial ovens at temperatures high enough to melt steel.
Wow. But what does that do to the inside of the stone?
The heat causes the natural microscopic inclusions inside the ruby to rapidly expand. The trapped gases blow out, leaving behind opaque white spots surrounded by jagged microscopic burst fractures.
It just cooks the internal geology.
Literally. Without a loop, the ruby looks beautifully red. But through the triplet lens, you see a graveyard of exploded crystals.
Wow.
The so-called flaws are the only barrier separating a priceless natural wonder from a heavily manufactured illusion.
It brings us full circle, really. The spectrum of information we've unpacked today is just vast.
It covers so much ground.
Yeah, we started in the heavy industrial reality of the minting floor, examining the extreme mechanical stress of 265-ton hubbing presses and laser-frosted vacuum chambers just to manufacture a physical object.
And we arrived in the silent, hyper-focused world of a three-lens loop, searching for a microscopic lily pad or an ancient water bubble to prove a gemstone wasn't spun in a laboratory.
You know, looking at the trajectory of how we value these objects presents a really fascinating philosophical dilemma.
I can feel a big thought coming on.
Well, we are hurtling toward a societal model dominated by absolute sterile perfection. Currency is becoming entirely digital, invisible, and mathematically flawless.
And gemstones can now be grown in laboratories, atom by perfect atom, completely devoid of any internal chaos or impurities.
The algorithms in the labs are mass-producing perfection at scale.
Exactly the point. As this manufactured perfection becomes common, cheap, and easily accessible, the entire paradigm of luxury is going to invert.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Think about it. Will the accidental bag mark on a silver eagle or the chaotic intersecting rutile silk in a natural sapphire become the ultimate premiums?
Because they're unique.
Right. In a future where flawless is the default factory setting, physical imperfections might become the only definitive proof we have left that something is truly beautifully real.
The idea that the flaw itself is the ultimate luxury is a brilliant thought to leave on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
And to you listening, the next time you grab your keys and hear the jingle of pocket change or catch the light reflecting off a ring, take a second. Look past the shiny, polished surface. Remember the complex, violent, and intricate history hidden right there in the palm of your hand. Check the edge, hunt for the inclusions, and see what secrets you can find.